Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this Board of Supervisor meeting to order. The date is May 9th. The time is 9:03. If I could please ask everyone to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, I'm going to ask our Community Services Director, Kathy Harwell, to lead us in the pledge. And then please remain standing. Pastor Susan Bagley from the Celebration Center of Modesto will be leading us in prayer.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Father God, we are humbled to come before you and grateful. You are truly holy and just. In this place, we thank you for this day that you have given us and the opportunity to be grateful for our callings. You are invited into this meeting and into this county to see your will accomplished. May your blessing be upon Stanislaus County, spiritually, economically, and socially. I ask you to bless each of these servants giving of themselves for the sake of their families, the people, and the generations that follow. Meet each of their personal needs and guard over them, keeping them safe from the evil of this world. Lord, may wisdom, courage, strength, kindness, justice, and truth continue to be tools that they draw on in the days ahead. May the business discussed and the decisions determined be honorable. May the fiscal and human resources they have be expanded supernaturally in that you receive the glory. As the days go forward, let their strategies for this land, both for now and the future, prove to be fruitful for those that they serve. Today, this meeting is given to you, and in the name of Jesus, I pray, amen.
If that name sounds familiar to any of you, there's Pastor Bagley and Pastor Bagley. The team concept. Thank you for coming in. Thank you, Kathy, also for leading us in the pledge. Okay, now we're going to move on to item three, public comment period. It's an opportunity to speak on anything that is not on today's posted agenda. I have two speaker cards. The first one is Dr. Paul Golden. Good morning.
Morning. I'm here, well, Mayor, or Mr. Risen, other members of the supervisors and others. I'm here today on behalf of NAMI, but you all know all about NAMI, so I'm here to talk about a personal story. My name is Paul Golden. I was diagnosed 47 years ago in 1973 with major depression disorder. I was, retrospectively, in 1988, I had my first manic break and multiple hypomanias. Throughout, actually, retrospectively, I was having hypomanic episodes back to college. In 1973, I was 23. I talk about indescribable terror. Dr. James McClure, now deceased, saved my life. I actually originally did not know what was happening. ECT, well, medications back then were old, had many side effects, and weren't very effective. So ECT, or electroconvulsive therapy, was my silver bullet. I had six treatments, and I was back to Paul after the first three, and had three more treatments as an outpatient, and was right back to my medical rotation. The second big D hit in 1976 when I was at UCSF Medical Center. I called Dr. McClure in St. Louis and said, can I? And he said, oh, come on over. So I had six treatments as an outpatient over about 3 weeks, and then I was right back in San Francisco in my rotations. If I was 23 years now and not so enabled, I don't know what would have become of me. I practiced nephrology and internal medicine for 39 years, 5 at UCSF and 34 years here in Modesto. I retired in 2013. I have to emphasize that this is an incurable chronic disease. I don't like the word disease, by the way, because we don't mention diabetes, heart disease, emphysema as disorders. But because of the popular lexicon, I'll use bipolar disorder. As mentioned, I made my first, and just to demonstrate that, after the fifth major depression episode, I made my first and only attempt at suicide in October of 2012 at the age of 64. That would be 3 years ago. Two bullets, one shattered my right tibia and the other was through and through to the abdomen. I nearly succeeded, but I really don't think I wanted to die because I called 911 and said, I'm going to shoot myself, and I left the door unlocked. I have not mentioned the other limb of wellness for bipolar disorder, and that's to have a support group or person. I was lucky to have two wives who listened to me and educated themselves and knew their my medications as much as I did. They were sort of an early warning system of when I was starting to have the M. The D is easier for me to figure out. My first wife was Priscilla. She was from the Philippines. I met her during my residency in San Francisco. We married in 1977. She died in 1992 after an attempt to replace three heart valves as she was going into congestive heart failure. She died 1 week later, the day before discharge. I was raising two children at that point, ages 8 and 12, but I had to go on. However, 6 months later, I had one of these six episodes of major depression, but by then the medications were better, and so I never needed ECT again. My second wife, Sue, I knew for almost 8 years, and we married in 1977. We've been together now 23 years, and she's major able to tell me when I'm starting to get the M. In these last 4 years, I've made my second career, and that's for mental advocacy for mental illness. Besides writing two books, I've done public speaking, radio gigs. Really?
Go ahead and finish your thought.
I'll just mention that affective disorders, MDD and DAPD, run up the maternal line. In my case, up the maternal line all the way to my great-grandmother. I mentioned one example that we need Laura's Law. A article was in the New York Times. I'll just say that a patient was in crisis. He was sighted at a, he was homeless and sighted at a cave outside Albuquerque. And after 4 years, months of negotiations, he turned his back with the knife and received six bullets to his back. He had anosognosia, which is when you don't realize you have mental problems. Thank you for your time, and I would like to pass around my two books for your perusal. And what I've found by talking to people is that bipolar disease disorder is really epidemic and much higher than the statistics quoted. My last line is, I would expect that one of you or more have friends or relatives with bipolar disorder. Thank you for your time, and I'll pass around the books.
Thank you, Dr. Dolan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Joe Lambert.
I'm back. Thank you for having me again and speaking. I'm not going to talk about Laura's Law today, believe it or not, because you already know I'm in support of it. What I wanted to talk about is the outreach that we tried to get for my sister. And I numbered them. And the first, and they're not in any particular order, so the first thing we tried, one of the things we tried was calling the forensic team. And I was told that my sister was, while she was in jail, no one could see her because everyone was at a conference in Monterey. When we called the forensic team again, on a different occasion, we were told that they would not go out to the jail. But after pleading in desperation on the phone, I'm told to go to her court date to ask the public defender for restoration. Three, we tried the public defender speaking on behalf of the judge, and he states that he will not go, the judge will not go for restoration, and then proceeds to do his own mental health evaluation on my sister. Four, conservatorship. We called conservatorship twice, but was told it was difficult to get conservatorship in our county, and that during their once a month meetings with the PD, my sister was never mentioned in their mental health meetings. Five, we spoke to the watch commander, explained my sister is gravely disabled and all that was involved in that conclusion, in addition to my mother being approached by many on the streets pleading that something be done, otherwise she would be murdered simply because she was crazy. Six, we spoke to NAMI, and given the number of a family advocate, offered me a support group and encouraged me to take the family-to-family class, which I did. Seven, we contacted the family advocate. My mother, they spoke to my mother only to say that they also have a family member in this county that isn't getting helped, and there was nothing to do for, nothing could be done to help my sister. But they could offer my mother services. Eight, spoke to the deputy of mental health in the county jail and was told that he did not know she was ill and would make notation in her file for the next time she came in. I have no way of knowing if that really happened. Nine, requested help for her along with others, requesting policy change from our severely mentally ill community with Michelle Obama, because she did have a mental health campaign. But she couldn't help except to forward my information onto a mental health facility in Washington, D.C. 10, mental health in D.C. couldn't help her either, but could offer me services. 11, faxed public defender, district attorney, probation, informing them she was gravely ill, but no response, though the PD, the public defender's office, did have the facts in her file. Because when I started to explain her situation, when I spoke to him directly at her court date, he stated, yes, I have it all here, and showed it to me, but then went on to say that the judge wouldn't go for restoration. And when I stated I faxed him the paper, his response was, oh. 12, Modesto PD called numerous times from family and from neighbors. Eventually, my father was told not to call them anymore. 13, my parents pleading with attorneys when they did call for my sister to please don't do your job to get her off and put her in jail instead. 14, CPS explained her situation to the social workers, which only solidified the case against my sister to not have custody and was only offered voluntary parenting classes, rehab, etc. But they never had contact with my sister. Once my sister was released from doctor's hospital having given birth, she really plummeted greatly, and she wouldn't, there was no getting her in to speak to anybody. 15, spoke to the delivery room nurse explaining her mental illness and not to leave her alone with the baby. 16, my sister ended up in Ripon. Residents called the PD because they were scared of her and she was taken to the closest hospital. I spoke to the nurse and gave her diagnosis and she said exactly what she thought, that Elizabeth was schizophrenic. We were relieved that they were willing to listen and we thought maybe she would get help there because she was in a different county. 17, several 72-hour holds, one resulting in a 52-50, which gave us a huge sigh of relief and the family was able to breathe, but that was short-lived. Our understanding, it was overturned by a judge and she was released the same day. 18, I even reached out to my social worker cousin that lives on the East Coast that has an AOT program in New Jersey. We would have many wee hours of the morning Facebook chats about our system here in the county and the lack of help we have been experiencing. We also had conversations wee hours in the morning, 1 a.m. here and 4 a.m. there on the telephone. This is just what I can remember, and I'm sure there are other avenues I've tried, my parents tried, that are not coming to mind. Rhonda Allen, Linda Mayo, and I have been with meetings with supervisors, and one of them said, do you even know what programs we have here in the county? And the answer to that is no. In my research, when I tried to find help for Elizabeth, no programs were found that would help her except for Laura's Law. But if you want to know how families can be helped, well, that's an easier answer.
Wrap it up, please, Joe.
Okay, I just have one more sentence.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Yep.
If there was help for my sister, then the Behavioral Center on Claus Road, Modesto PD, Public Defender, District Attorney, Doctors Medical, CPS, Family Advocates, Mental Health Deputy in the jail, Watch Commander, Conservatorships, apparently don't know what those programs are either. Otherwise, it would have been shared with the family, and she would be alive with us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's the last speaker card I have. Does anyone else want to address this board during public comment? Okay, seeing none, much probably to the delight of our, oh, is there one more? Did you see? Okay. Much to the probable delight, we're going to take up the consent calendar first before we move on to the public hearings. Does any board member want to pull anything off the consent agenda? We do have one speaker card for A7. It's the approval to set a public hearing May 23rd at 9:30 to consider the appeal of the Planning Commission approval of the use permit for the Fruit Yard Amphitheater, and that's Michelle Bell. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you for the consideration of this item. I just wanted to briefly ask that you consider moving this item, if it is approved, to the June 13th meeting. Our neighborhood is pretty rural, and we'd like to have some time to prepare the residents in the area to participate in the mediation measures that we're proposing. We also have a meeting scheduled with the property owner of the permit and a meeting scheduled with one of the supervisors here today. We also have some different studies being conducted at this time, and we'd like a little bit more time. We do understand that the June 13th meeting is a budget meeting, so we understand that it's pretty impacted, but we would ask for the consideration to move to that date if possible.
Yeah, Chairman, first of all, our county code states decisions appealed to the Board of Supervisors shall be set for a specific time and place of public hearing at the next regularly scheduled meeting, which is today. And that the public hearing should be considered not later than 45 days on which the appeal is filed. This appeal was filed May 1st, so the latest you can hear it is your June 13th meeting. Unfortunately, there is only, besides this May 23rd date, June 13th is the only other available date. She was correct that June 13th is when we plan on bringing to you our proposed budget. Knowing the desire for the appellants to have this matter heard at a later date. We did contact the applicant, and they indicated that a delay may impact some of their scheduling for summer events. So it's up to your discretion as a Board of Supervisors whether you wish to hear this at the May 23rd meeting or the June 13th meeting. Given the applicant's concern, I put it on today's agenda to be set for May 23rd.
Okay. Any thoughts? Any board members? Your preference? I guess that means it's staying on May 23rd. By common consent? You have any?
I'll move the consent calendar.
Okay, so we're going to go back to the consent calendar. If there's no other comments on this, we'll go back to the consent calendar. All right. Entertain a motion.
Move to approve.
Thank you.
I will second that.
Motion and a second. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, motion carries 5-0. So, Michelle, I want to make sure, did Michelle, there she is. I want to make sure I get on the calendar too to meet with you guys. I want to meet with both sides also. So, thank you. Okay, now we're going to, being past the time of 9:05, we're going to move on to the public hearing consideration, the adjustment of fees as follows. A, the approval to introduce and waive the first reading of an ordinance to amend existing fees for the Department of Environmental Resources. Director Jamie Eggers presenting.
Good morning. Hi. Chairman Chiesa, board members, CEO Risen, County Council Doering, Jamie Eggers, Director of Environmental Resources. Joining me here at the table is Mary Mayhew, to my left, Assistant Director, and to my immediate left, Janice Main, also Assistant Director. This morning, we are asking you to consider a brief list of amended existing fees for the Department of Environmental Resources. The divisions within the department that this impacts are our hazardous materials, milk and dairy, and landfill divisions, but also we're asking to adjust our weighted labor rate, which basically touches each of the programs within the department. The modifications are due to program cost recovery, the need to recover our costs, and in the case of one fee that you're considering today, a change in the consumer price index. Our current weighted labor rate for the past few years has been $106 per hour. We're proposing to change that to $111 per hour. The primary reason for the change is an increase in salaries and benefits costs. In our hazardous materials division, we're asking you to consider two fee adjustments. First, the underground storage tank program, which was last modified in 2015. And we're asking you to consider a 15% increase on the per tank charge. And even with this increase, it would still leave a deficit in the program that we would propose to, a gap we would propose to close over the next 5-year period. And also in our hazardous materials division are above ground petroleum storage tank fees, and we're proposing a 10% increase there. Again, this leaves a deficit in the program that we would propose to close over the next 5 years. Moving on to our milk and dairy division, you first considered a change in these fees last year, so this is a continuation of trying to close the deficit in that program, and those were the first increases in many, many years. In this case, we're proposing a 9.23% increase to milk and dairy grade A and B fees, and we would close the deficit in this program over the next few years. And the same is proposed for our grade A and B other hoofed mammals, such as goat dairies. The same 9.23% increase, which still would leave a deficit that we would close over the next few years. Lastly, in our landfill division, we have one fee that is tied to the consumer price index, and that is the ash disposal fee. It's a tipping fee per ton. and it suggested each year up or down because it's tied to the waste energy contract. And this year, the fee is changing by 50 cents per ton. We held stakeholder meetings back in early March, and overall, the feedback from the participants of the two workshops was favorable to all of the proposed needed amended fees. Our public notices for the workshop were printed in the Modesto Bee on February 25th and 26th, and the fees were also posted on the department's website on March the 3rd. So the staff recommendation is to introduce and waive the first reading of an ordinance to amend existing fees for the Department of Environmental Resources. If approved today, the fees would be effective June 23rd, with the exception of the one landfill fee, which each year becomes effective on July 1st. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for staff?
I was just curious why we even inspect above ground fuel tanks. What is the purpose of that? I can see underground tanks, but it seems like the above ground tanks is more of a leave raking jobs program.
We inspect them, we started inspecting them when we were required by the state to do so.
I didn't hear your answer.
We started inspecting above ground tanks when we were required by state law to do so.
And what do? Do you just look for leaks or what? I mean, what is it you're inspecting?
That's part of the process. Do you want to address that question, Janice?
Good morning. Good morning, Supervisor DeMartini. When it comes to the above ground storage tank program, that is, of course, handled by our hazardous materials unit. They do check for leaks. They do conduct an above ground storage program inspection once every 3 years. Incorporated in that process, I think you're familiar with the CSRS, the California Environmental Reporting Process. That's been a new program for us, and it is once again state mandated and has been very tedious for our staff. It's required additional training. We offer a one-on-one training in office and occasionally one-on-one training on site.
Well, I guess if the state requires it, we have to do it, but I just can't imagine the training requirements for looking for a leak in an above ground tank would take very long.
Well, it would cover more than just the on-site inspection. We also have administrative issues, the Envision program, which is also a proprietary, which requires licensing on an annual basis. That's been an additional cost that we've had to recoup. And I apologize. And then also additional staff training in order to process that.
Mistake. Did you say a leaf raking program?
That's what I would call it. Inspection of above ground tanks is a jobs program that was
carrying out the mandate.
Wonder if any other states do such foolish things.
I'm not sure about other states, but our costs and oversight for the smallest tank sizes are much more much less than in many jurisdictions. So we understand that new programs are never popular, but we have to do what we're required to do.
Supervisor Withrow?
Yeah, we all share Jim's frustration with this, and we know there's state mandates. But actually, if we didn't do these, wouldn't the state do this? For even they would come in and do this if we weren't to carry out these services? Does the state then? Does the state have that option to? If we didn't perform these inspections, would the state come in at a higher cost and probably
dairy?
I'm going to let the hazardous materials manager answer that question for you. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Bronya Benjamin. I'm the hazmat manager. To answer Mr. DeMartini's question, it's not just training one-on-one. We have to certify our inspectors to be APSA certified when we send them. It was through San Diego, now we are doing it online. And the state fire marshal will take care of that training. So we inspect 10,000 gallons, and if you store 10,000 gallons of petroleum product or more, we'll inspect you, but the state, the state fire marshal are asking us to add six more components for the facilities who store 1,320 gallons, where we check your SPCC plan. We need the inspector have to spend more time to check that you are covered because it's a federal requirements. So we do inspection, we check your information, your documentation. We need to make sure that it's entered in SIRS. And so every single staff spent around half to maybe 1 hour just on the 1,320 gallons. If it's more than 10,000, then we spent probably 2 to 3 hours doing inspections. As far as the state, yes. If we don't have the CUPA programs, which I trained the down south DTSC who took the CUPA programs from the county, they ask for fees that's maybe 10 to 20 times more. So if we give out the program to the state fire marshal, which was with the water board for years and they were collecting money and didn't do any inspection, if we give it back to the state, probably, which we looked at it when we introduced the fee in 2010, I looked at the fees that the water board was charging was way more than what we charge now, 20 some years ago. So I rather keep the CUPA programs, including the APSA program, here in our county where we charge decent fees and deal with business to get them into compliance and the state take it over and charge way more than we charge.
Very APSA nice. Is above ground storage tanks.
Yeah, so as, like I said, as frustrating as this is, we're the best alternative for our taxpayers here in our county. If it wasn't us, it'd be the state, it'd be much worse, so.
You can check, if you want, you can check any CUPA program that's run by the state and see the enforcement process and see how many fines they find businesses for not complying and plus the fees that they charge.
At the smallest tank size, which is regulated, which is 1,320 gallons, we actually...
we don't charge
any fee. We don't have a fee for the tank itself. It's no charge.
We're among the few counties who did not charge for 1,320. We start charging above 10,000 gallons, petroleum or more.
I would personally prefer local control rather than the state, because the more we can control it and work with it, the better off we are. When it gets out of hand, then we have no input, and then our local community has no input in it at all. So I prefer, as you're doing it, we have local control.
I agree with you.
I'll echo that. I'll just say the last thing we need is a jobs program within the State Water Board. So let's keep it here.
We have the jobs program here at the county instead.
So, understanding it is not an attack on staff. It is just to highlight the absurdity of some of the programs.
I understand, and I appreciate it. I'm here to explain our division and how we work with our businesses. We really want to keep our businesses in the county and try to help them. We had staff that went above and beyond to go to businesses' houses to help them out with certain submittals. We're working here to really get you get the businesses in compliance before the state send their inspectors and, you know, fine businesses for not being compliant.
Yeah. Well, these inspections are every 3 years?
Yes. They above 10,000 gallons is every 3 years.
And the fee, is this yearly or every 3 years?
It's an annual fee. It's an annual fee.
Okay, so you got to say, man, I just can't let go of this here because it's so stupid. It's so California. You have, you know, a 10,000-gallon tank, so you're charging $359 a year. You can go out once every 3 years for about an hour, maybe two, look for leaks. So, you know, the person's paying $1,200 in 3 years for about a two-hour inspection. It just seems so out of line that you wonder why businesses are leaving California at stuff like this. This is why.
You guys thought this was going to be a slam dunk, didn't you? And then we just wanted to give you a chance to come up here and talk a little more.
No, we appreciate your questions. Thank you.
Yeah. I don't know how you can justify a fee of $1,200 for an inspection every 3 years for 2 hours.
Is it because you're subsidizing the small tanks? I mean, essentially, aren't we? Because we don't have a fee structure on the small tanks?
Well, most small tanks are associated with farms, and there is an annual fee that they're paying.
Okay. And you guys helped me because I couldn't figure out the sewer system either the first time. I know I came in, and I appreciate it.
Right. That's part of the one-on-one assistance that we offer.
So any other questions for staff? If not, I'm going to open the public hearing. Anyone like to comment? Seeing none, close the public hearing, bring it back for action to introduce and waive the first reading of an ordinance to amend the existing fees for the Department of Environmental Resources.
And I just want to add that we have had briefings on this before. It seems like this isn't the first time we've looked at this, and we appreciate the briefings you guys do beforehand and let us see what the fees are, and we have discussions at that point, I know, of if we feel it's good or bad, and I mean, none of us really enjoy these things, but it's something that we have to do, so we appreciate the briefings we get ahead of time.
Is that a motion?
That is a motion to approve.
Thank you.
Second it.
I have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. Carries 5-0. Moving on to public hearing B, approval and introduce and waive the first reading of an ordinance to modify the existing inter-system bus transfer fee for Stanislaus Regional Transit. Matt.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Supervisors, Mr. Doring, Mr. Eisen, Matt Machado, Director of Public Works. And the item before you this morning is a public hearing to introduce and waive first reading of an ordinance to modify existing intercity bus transfer fees for our transit system, START. Intercity, and the focus here is our fixed route to an additional fixed route to another agency's fixed route. We're proposing a fee of 25 cents to make this change, to make this transfer. I'll share with you that all the other agencies already charge a 25 cent transfer fee. In fact, there is a fee chart attached to the item this morning that shows that. The 25 cent we haven't charged in the past, but because of fare box ratio changes, we feel it necessary to charge this fee. If adopted, this fee would generate a little more than $9,000 a year. And that, even though it sounds like not a lot of money, it would go a good distance to help us obtain the new required fare box ratio of 15%. I'll also share that our current fare box ratio is just north of 10%, and that was the old standard, 10%. The new standard is 15, so we are striving to get to that mark. This next fiscal year, we believe we will be just north of 13%, so we're not there yet. This $9,000, if approved today, we've included that in our proposed budget. So we're hopeful that this 25 cent fare rate does go through. But 13% is still not 15. But fortunately, we have 2 years to get to the 15% mark. So this is just one of the steps we'll be taking. Some of the other steps that we'll bring to this board will be our MJC agreement. We hope to bring that in early June, and that'll generate new revenue for us, and that'll help us get to our fare box ratio. Measure L has a small component for transit that'll help us get to our fare box ratio. So we hope by year two, and I will also share that we may have to cut some services. Some of our services are not that efficient. We will be looking to cut some of those services because we have to. Not because we want to, but we have to. So by year two, we plan to get to the 15% fare box, and we will be in good order at that point. And I know that's a bit off topic for the 25 cent fare increase today, but I feel like telling you the whole story is important. So, but the item before you today is a 25 cent transfer fee so that when people are riding our bus and they get to a station and they want to transfer to another service, say MAX or the Series or Turlock system, they pay us 25 cents, we give them a ticket, and when they get on the next bus, they provide the ticket instead of having to pay full fare of that bus service. So it's still a good deal for our citizens, but it is a new one. So with that, I turn it to the board for any questions you may have.
Maybe not a question, but a comment. Maybe you can explain how everyone had to increase their fare box recovery ratio, which was already tenuous at best for most of the operators.
Sure. So the primary funding for transit is through TDA. It's a state sales tax that's collected and distributed to all agencies. We call it TDA, Transportation Development Act. And so the rules that fall under TDA, one of those rules is fare box ratio. And recently, about a year ago, it was we hit a mark. Actually, it was in the, I think it was the 2010 census, we hit the over 500,000 mark for urbanized areas. And so that started this process of implementing the higher farebox ratio. And so for the rural system like ours, we went to 15%. The cities actually are going to 20%. The true urban cities are going to 20% farebox ratio. So that's a tough mark to meet. And it's because our overall population is north of 500,000. Now, we don't necessarily believe that to be fair. And at the COG level, we are looking at options, possibly federal or state legislation, to further define what an urban area is, because we don't feel like 500,000 population makes us an urban county. We're truly suburban. So we're looking at that, but nonetheless, the law states that we must meet these higher farebox ratios today, and so we are implementing them now.
Okay. Any questions?
A few follow-up questions. You just answered some of them, but is there a waiver process, or would it just require legislation?
It would require legislation. So, and what it is, if you read the legislation today, I think there's probably some gray areas, so it's not a hard change. I think just a clarification of defining what urban is and what urban isn't, and maybe defining us as a suburban area and allowing us to set our own farebox ratios based upon performance standards and other standards that we can manage ourselves. The goal of farebox ratio is to encourage transit operators to be efficient, which makes great sense. We all want to be efficient, but we feel like we could probably do that ourselves through different methods, not just farebox ratio. So we think a clarification and possibly some flexibility in the state law would allow us to craft our own rules and regulations to keep ourselves efficient.
And what is the consequence of not meeting the farebox ratio if at the same time we can demonstrate we're seeking change?
So if we get to that end of that second year and say we haven't met our farebox requirement, the amount that allowed us not to meet that ratio is the penalty. So let's say we meet 14%, so that 1% difference, you calculate what that fare should have been, that dollar amount, mm-hmm. and that's the penalty.
Okay. And are we working, I assume we are, if we're doing this through the COG, but are we working with the cities so that they can also seek law changes? Because
yes.
I know Riverbank and Oakdale, they'll never get to 20%.
Well, correct.
They couldn't even get to 10%.
So Riverbank and Oakdale, we consolidated with them. So
yeah.
They are us.
They are.
Yeah.
Which is okay, which is good.
Which is the only way they got around it.
But you make a good point. The cities of Ceres and Turlock will have a really difficult time meeting the standard. Modesto may make it as is at 20%. They have enough ridership. But no, we're all band together.
Okay.
We're looking at this together. Yep.
Okay. And then lastly, since you mentioned that we might have to get more efficient in our routes and cancel some routes,
yes.
How often do we look at the routes that are offered today and get feedback from consumers to make sure that we're providing the best routes and delivery services?
Continuously.
Okay.
And so we go to every public event. There's about 32 of them in the county, and we're at every one. We have a booth. We take input. We're asking people. We ask our riders what they need, what they want. We actually are implementing some ITS, information technology stuff on our buses, so that we can track people's movements more closely and track their needs, and we think we can become more efficient through information technology. And then every year we do route changes. Small tweaks usually, and that's in August. In fact, I didn't mention, but if this fare is adopted, it would be implemented August 21st, I believe, August 21st. And that's when we implement any route changes. So we look at them continuously. We make changes annually. I will tell you the fixed routes are typically not our problem. Those are pretty efficient. It's our dial-a-ride service that's very inefficient, where we're running across the county to pick up one person for $1.50, or you know, it varies a little bit depending on the rider. But those services, even though they're greatly needed, they're very expensive to run. So we will try to streamline and make those efficient, and possibly even supplement with some fixed route expansions if that's possible.
Okay, and now I have two more questions. I thought I was done. So one is, what's our method for letting people know that there's now going to be this transfer fee? Because a quarter doesn't sound like a big deal, but it can be a big deal to people.
It is a big deal. And so about 30 days ago, we posted on our website and on all of our transit buses and in the local newspapers of this proposed fare change. And I mentioned the August 21 date, but we'll continue to advertise this fare change right up to the last day so people can be ready.
Okay.
And so you're right, 25 cents doesn't seem like a lot, but we will get some pushback for sure.
Yeah,
so
we'll be promoting it in the areas of the riders, not just through the newspaper.
Yep. Okay. Exactly right.
Okay, and then finally, sort of way off topic, but related, have we ever looked at, you mentioned how expensive and inefficient the Dial-A-Ride program is, which makes sense. Have we ever looked at contracting with a service like Uber or Lyft or any other ride-sharing services? Would that be less expensive?
So you must be reading all of our minds, because we're doing that with it's a UC Davis study. In fact, there is a meeting conference call, I think it's this week, and they're looking at a pilot program for those outlying areas where the Dial-A-Ride is very, very expensive, to see if Uber, Lyft, if those services could supplement some of our transit services. And we're all for it. And so UC Davis is leading the effort. There's a grant out there that they're taking advantage of. There's a local match that we're trying to put together now. And so we're working together to find out that exact answer to that question.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Coming before the COG next Wednesday, the contract.
Yep.
And Kristen kind of read my mind there, and like Vito said, that is coming before the COG. But I look at this and it's just frustrating. And Matt, we've talked about this before a little bit, but you know, we spend hundreds and hundreds of thousands on these buses, and we talk about, like Kristen said, expensive, inefficient. I look at this as almost, and then we worry about the fare box. We're trying to always make the fare box, now they're raising that. And so I look at that as a symptom. We're just treating the symptoms. The disease is, this is an obsolete system that doesn't work anymore. And I know there's people that need to get from different places, but we need to find out, you know, a 21st century approach to this compared. And I know this study that's coming, this pilot program maybe that's coming, is the start of that. But the world has changed, and we need to figure out another way to do it rather than spend $500,000 on a bus that's got three people driving around on it in the county, and we're trying to get five people riding on it so that we can meet our fare box, you know. There's got to be a better way to do this. And so we continue to, like I say, trying to treat this symptoms of this, but we just don't seem to get to the root cause of the problem. And the world has changed. There's better ways to do this now, and we've got to find a better system to do this. So,
well,
not that you can do that today.
No, but I would like to share a comment. You know, we carry about 400,000 people a year on our system. And even though some of the buses feels like they're empty, they're usually not. We get calls nearly every day about the value of this system. And it feels rough because of the cost. But we are a lifeline service. And so I don't know what the next step is for transit. I know in a lot of areas they go to like a light rail or something that, you know, the fare box ratios typically are higher, or like even heavy rail. Fare box ratios are 50%. But on these small, short trips that are very unique, I'm not sure how to replace that.
But that's maybe where the Uber or the Lyft or some sort of different, where we contract with somebody different. Instead of a $500,000 bus, we've got a little Fiat taking somebody somewhere.
It's
just a different approach compared to the way we've been doing it.
It's totally true, and that's why that UC Davis study is going to be really exciting. But we all ride Uber, and I think, you know, $5-6 for a ride is probably about right. And our fares today are $1, $1.50, $1.75.
Yeah, but our cost isn't $1, $1.50, or $1.75. So you can, you know, don't, the comparison is not apples to apples.
It's not fair, but
yeah,
it's what people can afford.
Yeah, and there's no question that it is a lifeline for people. And we're not talking about taking away a lifeline for people, but we're talking about finding a better, more efficient way to do this. So.
I totally agree, and hope we can find it.
Does the urban designation for us, does Turlock, are they in the same category as San Francisco?
Yes, that puts them there. Exactly right.
And so we're right on the cusp. Again, 500,000, we're on the cusp of meeting these higher requirements, but the density isn't there except for in Modesto, essentially.
Right.
So, and there's three of the four operators are not meeting fare box, the new fare box.
That's
and
right.
I don't think more than two of them were meeting it before the increase. So I think we've got a real struggle going forward. And $20 million is what we essentially what we receive in TDA.
Yes.
a year for all the system, and we spend 95% of that anyway, 90%.
Yes.
So it'll be interesting, because I think on the one thing we're missing is that the paratransit, with the dial-a-ride, has to have the ability, right, to pick up folks that, that has to have some special accommodations on some of the vehicles.
Right.
And so if you have Uber or Lyft, that's
they
not going to be possible. You're
folks.
Still going to have some of the challenges. Yeah. But I think we can do it better. I think, and hopefully everyone's thinking, not just you, but the system is a blended system. Whether they're operated by four different people, it's still a blended system. It has to work together. So,
yes, sir.
All right. Any other questions from the board?
Sorry, Matt, more than you thought for 25 cents.
No, it's right. Good. It's good discussion. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, I'm going to open up the public hearing. Would like to comment? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing and approve and waive the first reading of the ordinance to modify the existing inter-system bus transfer fee for Stanislaus Regional Transit. Do I have a motion?
I will make a motion to approve staff recommendations.
A motion.
Second.
Second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
Moving on to item C, approval and introduce and waive the first reading of the ordinance to establish new fees and amend existing fees for planning services. Director Freitas.
Angela's afraid to come up here now.
Happy to be here. Good morning, Chairman Chiesa, and members of the board, Mr. Doran and Mr. Rising. Angela Freitas, Planning Director. And with me this morning is Mark Lozier, the Planning Department's Business Manager. We're here this morning to request approval of new and amended fees for planning services. And to start our presentation, I'll turn the microphone over to Mark.
It's a good morning. Just by way of background, the last comprehensive fee increase was adopted back in May of 2010. Since that time, there was one amendment specific to mining and reinspection fees, which were adopted on April 28, 2015. Right now, again, just by way of background, as part of the adopted final budget, the Board of Supervisors approved appropriations of $20,000 to conduct a comprehensive fee study within the department. The department just recently awarded a contract to Matrix, and we will anticipate completing that fee study analysis in the winter of 2017-2018. The planning fee schedule reflects separate fees for the following: the Planning Department, the Planning Commission Clerk, the Public Works Department, Department of Environmental Resources, Clerk of the Board, and for Maintenance Administration. Today, this item proposes an interim fee adjustment of 10%, and as part of that 10%, in the department's analysis, the first thing we did was we looked at actual costs incurred in the department, and we also looked at CPI indexes. So just really quickly, we looked at the All States region, the Western region, and San Francisco, San Jose region. So the first slide before you, what that reflects is the increased change from 2010 to 2017. So for all states in the U.S., it was a 14% increase in the CPI. For the San Francisco-San Jose region, it was 20%. And for the Western City regions, which includes California, it was 9.8% for that period. Similarly, we looked at the weighted labor rates for the department. And since the last fee was approved from 2010 to 2017, on average, we've seen an increase of approximately 20% in the weighted labor rates. So this morning, we're recommending a phase approach to adjusting the fee schedule. Approval of a 10% increase will bring the fees charged more closely aligned with the actual costs incurred to provide planning services. Once the fee study has been completed, we will return to you, and potentially additional fee adjustments may be necessary.
In addition to the 10%, the department is proposing some targeted fee increases. To Planning Commission Clerk and Clerk of the Board, fee has been increased to reflect an increased publication costs for legal notices. In a few cases, the Planning Commission Clerk fee has been eliminated for applications or activities that don't require legal notices, or where the fee reflected is an out-of-date recording fee. To address the recording fees, the fee schedule has been updated to reflect the required additional recorder fee if the document must be recorded is in addition to any other fee. Document recording fees will continue to be those set by the clerk recorder's office. a new fee for environmental studies and peer review of environmental studies has been added to the fee schedule. Currently, there is no adopted fee to allow for recovery of these costs when it's not associated with the project billed at actual cost. However, there are times when fixed cost projects require environmental studies to be prepared, such as traffic studies, biological studies, or noise studies. The department has service agreements in place to obtain the necessary studies, but not the authorization to charge for those studies. Currently, the applicant is required to obtain those studies directly and provide them to the department. However, we do have situations where there is a controversial project, and when the applicant's paying for those studies, sometimes there's an issue of bias that's claimed, and then we end up having to do a third-party peer review. So these fees would also cover the third-party peer review. Proposed fee would be actual cost with a deposit equal to the initial cost estimated for the study based upon agreed-upon scope of service. A new fee for field inspection and site visits needed to verify compliance with conditions of approval and mitigation measures has been added to the schedule. The proposed fee with a one-hour minimum deposit will be calculated annually based on the July 1st average weighted labor rate for planning staff assigned to perform the inspections. Site visits, the fee based on the July 1st, 2016 average weighted labor rate would be $69. A new fee for permit and zoning research has also been added. That fee is also an actual cost fee based on average weighted labor rates. A general note has been added to require that any application which has been inactive for 1 year or more be charged current applicable fees unless it's determined by the director that the work being performed under the original fee will not be not need to be revised and or updated. A general note has also been added to require that any application submitted to legalize or correct for a violation of county code shall be charged actual cost with a deposit amount equal to the adopted application fee. The fee for documents and media are proposed to be updated to reflect actual costs with the availability of the department's documents and Planning Commission materials online. These requests have become very rare. With those targeted fees and the 10%, there are no other charges that are being proposed by the planning department to the fee structure that was adopted back in 2010. Since 2010, the weighted labor rates charged by both the Department of Environmental Resources and Public Works as part of the planning fee schedule have been increased. This year, DER has proposed and has obtained approval to increase their weighted labor rates from 106 to 111 per hour. The proposed fee schedule is provided in attachment one of your board report. New fees and added notes are shown in bold text, and old fees are shown in stricken. The proposed fees also include just some general edits for cleanup purposes. So what do all of these proposed fee amendments really mean to the actual permit costs? The average proposed increase per application type not requiring a public hearing is anticipated to increase by $25. The average proposed increase per application type requiring a public hearing, including actual cost deposit applications, is $192. The average proposed increase per deposit for an actual cost application is $279. The proposed increase for two of the department's most common application types would be $230 for an agricultural use permit and $235 for an agricultural parcel map involving Williamson Act contracted land or requesting to create four or more parcels. The department has conducted a review of planning service fees for eight comparable counties, those being Fresno, Kern, Madera, Merced, Monterey, Sacramento, San Joaquin, and Tulare. A review demonstrates that the proposed total fee amount in many cases are either equal to or less than the total fees charged by other agencies. Some of the lower fees offered by other counties include lot line adjustments, parcel maps, tentative maps, and variances by Fresno County, lot line adjustments by Kern County, all application types by Madera County, all application types by Merced County, use permits by Sacramento County, rezones by San Joaquin County, and lot line adjustments by Tulare County. However, many of these lower fees found in the comparison counties have a range, with the high end of the range exceeding Stanislaus County's proposed fees. In addition, many of the comparable counties charge a California Environmental Quality Act CEQA review initial study fee in addition to their application fee. In Stanislaus County, our application fees include the CEQA review and initial study costs. The fee comparison with comparable counties is provided in attachment 2 of your board report.
So prior to levying a new fee or amending an existing fee, the county is required by Government Code 54985 to hold a scheduled public hearing as part of the regularly scheduled meeting with the Board of Supervisors. The board may introduce and waive the first reading of an ordinance to establish new fees and amend existing fees of the Planning and Community Development Department. If approved, these fees will become effective on June 23, 2017. The increase in revenue resulting from the approval of this interim fee is expected to partially offset direct costs relating to processing land use permits and Williamson Act contracts and the ongoing provision of services. Revenues to the Planning and Community Development Department may potentially increase by approximately $15,000 based on fiscal year 2016-2017 permitting volume. Today, that we have one staff recommendation, and that's to conduct a public hearing to introduce and waive the first reading of an ordinance to establish new fees and amend existing fees for planning services. And with that, we will answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for staff? Supervisor Withrow?
Okay, everybody's cranky up here today, I guess. Maybe that's why we're bugging you guys so much. But just one quick question or quick point here. Totally get this, the CPI indexes that we use, everything, the comparisons national or San Francisco regional, so very good. The one thing that just seemed distorted to me that I just wanted to make sure that we point out, when we talk about the department's weighted labor rates have increased approximately 20% since 2010, I don't know that that's true. That almost sounds like we have increased, you know, what we're paying the department by 20% or, you know, whether it's in benefits or anything. And I'm just afraid maybe that's, again, I'm fine with this. I know that it's, but that little point stands out and makes it sound like, geez, I want to work in planning department. They've got a 20% increase over the last 7 years. And I know we've had the cuts, and I think we maybe have pulled out like a little picture there of a window, but we maybe part of that's restoring cuts that the planning department, that all departments took during that period of time. So anyway, I'm not sure how you guys can address that, but I just don't, that distorts things a little bit when it sounds like we've increased 20%.
Sure, so as part of our analysis, what we did was we looked back from 2010 to 2017, and we looked at the classifications that are most commonly involved in processing these applications. So they include the assistant planner, the associate planner, and the senior planner. And we looked at two of those classifications, and we looked at the existing staff that had been in the department from 2010 to 2017. And we looked at the overall salaries, we looked at the benefits, and we looked at the indirect costs. And so that calculation of the 20% looks at those positions, and it analyzes the salaries, the benefits, and the indirect costs from 2010 to 2017. And we looked at the weighted labor rate at 2010 for those positions, and we looked at ending in 2017.
Okay, so is it an increase in personnel with those costs? Is that what you're saying? I think, Mark, that it's more of an increase in personnel.
I think it's pension, health care, indirect costs.
Yes.
Restoration, the 6% pay cut.
Yeah, because they were at 6% down. Even though they're only up 1%,
you've got
7%.
Okay, and just want to make sure that people don't think we haven't raised wages by 20% in the planning department.
Okay. Yeah, and good, duly noted. That's good for the public to understand that. But pension costs, health care, Supervisor Olson.
Thank you. So bear with me, colleagues and staff. I have a lot of questions. So one, in follow-up to what Supervisor Withrow just asked, if I understand, I want to make sure I understood the response correctly. So does that mean per application we're more heavily weighting the salary of a senior planner as opposed to an assistant planner? And that's how, because even with the explanation of health care and pension, that's still not going to get anywhere near 20%. So is the formula different now than it was in 2010?
What we examined were the beginning weighted labor rates in 2010, and we then looked at them at 2017 and looked at that change. And so in terms of the staff that's assigned to processing the application, we looked at the classifications that most commonly would have touched it. So when it came across the counter, which classification would have touched it? And, you know, the primary classification is your assistant and associate planner that process those day-to-day, you know, the applications.
Okay. Okay. So one of the things that concerns me, and this is partly a comment as well, but one of the things that concerns me when I was looking at all the comparables in the fees between the different counties is there's so much variance. I've never seen so much variance between counties on fees, which really has nothing to do with us per se, isn't our fault, but I just wondered, is there a structure in place where planning departments across the eight valley counties, at least, maybe it's part of the San Joaquin Partnership, or I don't know, can have a conversation about maybe streamlining those a little bit? Because I just think of many developers in the private sector work across counties, and I just can't even imagine the headache and having to deal with things that are so vastly different, and I'm wondering what an explanation could be for such extreme variance from one county to another. And again, if there's a structure in place where that could be conversed about and perhaps changed over time.
Coming together with one uniform fee is not a conversation that I've heard even thought of to have. As far as the variations in the fee, I think a lot of it is based on just different agencies and their aggressive natures in obtaining, you know, full recovery of all actual costs. Some of it may have to do with dealing with contract staff versus in-house staff. You know, some of the environmental work just gets farmed out to outside consultant companies. They're going to charge more, and there's going to be an added cost. But you're correct. It's all over the board in terms of where those costs are, and I don't have a good answer here today to really explain why those costs vary so much.
Okay. It's just really hard to assess whether, you know, we're middle of the road or what, because it's just all over the map. But thank you. So one of the questions I had is, why would we raise the fees now if our fee study isn't coming back until this winter? Why don't we just wait and do it all at one time? Is there a reason for that?
We feel very comfortable that the fees that we're asking for are in line with what our costs are, that we're not increasing the fees beyond what the cost of the applications are. It's an interim step so that we're not, you know, waiting a whole other year to increase the fees. We would have liked to have had the fee study here today. That didn't happen, but we felt it was prudent to move forward to make the first step, an interim increase this year, get the study done, and then come back with the second increase as kind of a phased approach rather than just wait another year.
That makes sense. So you have a high confidence level that these fees are at or below what the fee study will suggest.
Yes, we've gone through, we've been charging, you know, some of our applications are already actual costs. We've gone through, done analysis of those. They're really, if you take an actual cost application and you take off the end part, which is coming to the board, you can pretty much get a good representation of what the cost would be. And we feel that the proposed fee increases are right in line.
Okay. And then do we provide, and I apologize, I'm still learning all the departments in the county, so my knowledge is more based on city stuff from years ago, but do we provide certain timelines to applicants in return for the fees that they're paying?
In terms of processing the application?
Processing the application, knowing when they can plan on phase two of construction or whatever the project entails.
That's a very big part of the communication that we try to have with our applicants. In our world, however, it's rarely ever a perfect world. We try to factor in, you know, ideally for applications to go Planning Commission, we'd like to be through in 3 to 4 months. The reality is with just staffing and permit volumes, we're probably running more of a 5 to 6 month realm. We always just try to communicate to the applicants. A lot of it depends on what issues come up, but it's an ongoing conversation. But we do try to move them through as fast as we can.
Do we track how often we're meeting the timelines?
We don't have a set statistic that we're tracking on a regular basis, but that information is not difficult
to discover. Okay, great. And then I know I might have misunderstood this slide because we were going really quickly, but I think one of the slides said that we're increasing costs for the fees associated with posting legal notices. And that was puzzling to me because if anything, since 2010, I would think costs associated with that would have gone down as we've moved to more of an online world.
We still have to publish in the local newspapers, and those costs have gone up.
Okay, so is that a requirement that we publish in the newspaper?
It is a requirement that we publish.
Okay, and then finally, you mentioned two or three brand new fees that we haven't had before. Is that in response to new mandates from the state or the feds or new programs?
No, they're just areas where at this point there is effort being undertaken by staff and there is no opportunity for cost recovery, and so we want to make sure that we are recovering whatever costs are appropriate. In some cases, like the verification for conditions of approval and mitigation measures, we've started adding that into conditions of approval that the applicant would have to pay for those costs, but we just prefer to have a structure where we can just charge for those when the inspections are needed, and not every project requires an inspection.
Okay. Okay, I appreciate you answering all my questions so thoroughly. I obviously, as you can tell, have concerns anytime we raise fees related to planning and economic development, because I just think we're so far behind as a county when it comes to attracting those types of projects. So I just always want to make sure that we are doing nothing more than cost recovery, and sometimes maybe it's appropriate even to do less than that as we incentivize opportunities here.
I totally
appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Stan?
Yeah, if I could add a little clarification. First of all, the law doesn't allow us to do any more than cost recovery. And planning actually is a general fund department that's heavily subsidized by general tax dollars for a lot of the services that they provide at the counter that are just subsidized with tax dollars. As to the 20% over a seven-year period, if I could address that real quick, the average county employee, especially those that would be in this particular department, are up 1% over where their salary would have been pre-recession. But during this 2010 period, I believe they were taking a full 6% pay reduction. So if you add that 6% and 1% together, that accounts for 7% of the 20% increase. Also, this is a weighted labor rate, which means we look at overhead costs as well. And so you have to add in retirement, which is average. Well, I don't know what our average retirement increase has been. But for example, our health insurance has averaged 7% increase a year over the seven-year period. We also know that we have had some significant increases in our retirement costs over this time period. So when you start putting all those pieces together, it probably is easy to get to 20%. I think what's important to note is that for the average salary of someone in this department, they're maybe 1% ahead of where they were pre-recession.
Okay, I think that's great to point out, and now we beat you up, now I'll defend you. You know, we really need to consider, we're talking about direct and indirect costs. We just had that last week with our clerk recorder and what issues going on there, that's how we arrive at those fees, and just the indirect costs that are associated with having staff available all the time when somebody walks in, all those different things, all the different overhead costs we talk about. We've got to bring that into the whole picture of determining what our actual cost is. So then I defended you guys after that. Thank you.
Yeah. I think in most of our discussions, the first question I always ask is, how do we compare to the other counties in the valley? So that is very important. I will tell you the difficulty is that we can't harmonize our fees within the nine cities in the county, let alone stepping outside of our boundaries. But yet, cumulative impact is what potentially attracts business. Now, we shouldn't be subsidizing with general fund dollars the fees on the outside, because that's taxpayers subsidizing a business, essentially. So I understand. I will go back to the model. When we wait 7 or 8 years to raise fees rather than what we do at the landfill, and Jamie, I see Jamie has left, but we have essentially a quotient where we use diesel labor rates, and we're literally adjusting 25 cents, just like our bus rates, 22 cents. There was even a year that we reduced rates. There are no complaints because we're just charging the actual fee. You're caught in a situation where you haven't adjusted your fees, and now 20% looks pretty difficult to accept. So I do understand that. Just recognizing that the political pressure that's up here. So maybe we don't wait 7 years to update fees. I know you guys are all shaking your heads. Stop shaking your heads because that means fee increases every year. But better to do it 20 cents than to do $2. Better to do it $10 rather than $100. So something to keep in mind. Any other questions for staff? All right. Open the public hearing. Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing and looking for an approval to introduce and waive the first reading of the ordinance to establish new fees and amend existing fees for the planning services. I have a motion.
I will make that motion.
Three in a row. Have a second.
I'll second it.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. 5-0.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, moving on to correspondence.
This board has received letters from the Governor's Office of Emergency Services regarding the U.S. Small Business Administration and the U.S. Department of Agricultural Disaster Declarations for primary and contiguous counties, including Stanislaus County, due to economic impacts caused by severe storms and flooding that occurred in January 2017.
Refer to the Office of Emergency Services and the Agricultural Commissioner and Sealer of Weights and Measures.
This board has received a letter from the State Water Resources Control Board regarding the formation deadline for groundwater sustainability agencies.
Refer to the Department of Environmental Resources.
This board has received the claims as noted on the agenda.
Acknowledge receipt of claims and refer to the Chief Executive Office Risk Management Division. Are there any Board of Supervisor reports? Okay, seeing none, Legislative Fiscal Management Report, CEO Risen.
Yeah, just briefly, first of all, the governor intends to issue his May revise this Thursday morning. So we're going to be nervously watching that, especially as it relates to IHSS, hoping that we see some progress on reducing the impact to counties in that May revise. Also, the other thing that we're watching with a nervous eye is what happens on the federal front. Now that the House has passed some reform related to the Affordable Care Act, which would cause for a decrease in Medi-Cal expansion, I think by the year 2020, that could have a significant impact on us as a county organization. We had thousands of folks on our medically indigent adult rolls, which we are ultimately responsible for funding. Prior to Medi-Cal expansion, and so if we lose that Medi-Cal expansion, it could have some pretty significant consequences for us at the county level. So we'll be watching that as it moves on to the Senate. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. We do have a closed session. We're going to adjourn this meeting. Closed session, Mr. Doering.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have conference with legal counsel pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9, Subdivision D2. This matter is to discuss significant exposure to litigation involving one matter. We do not expect a report out from this. It'd be appropriate to ask if there are any public comments, but I wouldn't think the public would know what to comment on. So,
is there any public comment regarding closed session? Seeing none, we will adjourn to closed session.